Seth Godin is the author of 18 bestsellers. He's a popular blogger, and he's the founder of the Alt MBA. His newest book is What to Do When It's Your Turn, and he's launching it in Product Hunt. On the podcast, we discuss marketing and distribution, how to build online communities, and what he's learned from his various education experiments. All right, here's Seth.
Seth, thank you for coming on the podcast. We're talking about your turn. We'll get into other things as well. But first, let's start there. This is your 17th book, and it's a book that it's a call to action book. And you're also going about it in an interesting way, which we'll talk about that as well. But first, talk about your turn. For those who haven't read it, tell us a little bit about it, and talk about what inspired the creation of it.
Well, I hope it's okay. I'd like to pivot off the idea that we're talking, you know, on the Product Hunt radio network here. Why is Product Hunt so addictive and so powerful? What's going on there that makes really busy, successful people volunteer their time and attention to work their way through these products that are being hunted, right? And I think it's pretty new. And that means that, you know, when I was 20 or even 30, the idea was, other than, say, records and movies, you knew what you wanted and you bought what you wanted at the cheapest price. So if you were looking for a pair of shoes that was good enough at the cheapest price, that's what you bought. And what software has done, and that has spread to so many other products, is turned more and more of the things we touch in our lives into art. And by art, I mean human work, personal work, things that change us. And we are willing to go out of our way to seek that out and to pay extra for it. So if you think about something like Kickstarter, everything on Kickstarter is at some level personal, and at some level new, and at some level interesting. And that seems obvious when you're living in the middle of it, but most of us need to take a step back to realize it's not obvious. It's pretty new. And you can travel around the world, and it's not the norm, right? It's a New York norm. It's a San Francisco norm. It's an online norm. But you're not going to find it walking down the streets in Sao Paulo or Buenos Aires or someplace like Athens. That what's happening is, in a post-industrial economy, more and more of the people who have a choice are making the choice of buying and supporting and paying attention to things that are personal and that are real and that are art, which leads to this book. It's called Your Turn. And I really, after the four I did for Kickstarter a couple years ago, I had decided that there really wasn't any more space on most people's bookshelves or in my head to write an 18th book. People have sort of moved away from consuming books as the way that they are learning things. The internet has really hammered that approach. And I don't want to force people to buy something that involves cutting down a tree if they'd rather read a blog post instead. But what happened was, I did a free seminar in my office for some really amazing people almost a year ago, and made an audio of some of the key moments, and brought that audio to market. It's called Leap First. And I realized a lot of people aren't going to listen to an audio, so I started using InDesign to illustrate it and make it into something that was different than a book, that felt shareable and chewable and inspiring. And that's what Your Turn is. It's a oversized, high-quality paperback that's sort of like a magazine, filled with illustrations. I laid the whole thing out myself. And what's fascinating to me about it is the feedback I'm getting. The feedback usually I get from a book is, I bought this book, I sat in my room for a couple days, I read it, and it changed me. And what people are saying about this book is, I bought 5 copies, or I bought 8 copies, I handed them out to my team, and it changed us. And that makes me really happy.
Yeah, and what's interesting is that you're not only thinking about how to be innovative on the content side, but also on the medium in which people experience that content side. And it seems that more and more authors are either going that way or need to go that way in terms of getting their ideas spread.
Right. And I know that you've been personally spending time talking to authors lately. And here's the thing. Book publishing for 400 years was about making bookstores happy. That's who they think the customer is. And so things were made to get shelf space in the bookstore. Well, guess what? In the last 5 years, the bookstore has ceased to matter to many readers and to therefore many authors. And so pleasing the bookstore isn't the point. My book sold, you know, fully illustrated at the price point I'm charging, where you have to buy 5 copies at a time to get a good price, would never work in a bookstore. But that's okay, because I don't need to do that.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, I'm curious, you know, there's so much I want to ask you, but, you know, this is, if you call this book, this is, you know, 18th, you know, book you put out, you're so prolific. Ultimately, what's been the North Star for you in terms of, you know, that explains your dedication to doing this? What's been, you know, the most inspiring, what's most inspired you?
Well, you know, I used to be in the book business. That's what I did for a living before I started my first internet company. And in those days, that's what I did for a living. I don't write books for a living. I write books because I have passion for change, because I want to hear from someone that some words I shared in a format that was comfortable for them helped them see the world a different way. And I've never once woken up in the morning and said, I wonder what book I should write next because it's time for me to write a book. Instead, if I'm overcome with a need to write a book, I do. So sometimes I'll write, you know, 2 books in a year, and sometimes I'll go years apart, because writing and publishing books is not as fun as it looks. And I do it when I have to. I don't do it because I want to.
Yeah, it's a slog.
It is indeed.
And, you know, your gift for packaging ideas and just curiosity and also understanding have you always had this ability? Was it something, you know, what's your kind of natural ability that allows you to do it? And did you notice this ability in growing up in school?
So I am not in any list that also includes Michael Jordan. That's very clear. But when Michael Jordan played basketball in high school, he was benched almost all the time. Michael Jordan does not have natural ability in the sense that he came out of the womb dunking basketballs. And I don't believe I have a natural ability to do what I do. I think that I decided a long time ago that I liked the cycle. I liked the people I got to work with doing it. I enjoyed the process of noticing things and explaining them. But I think it's a learned process. And I think that once, you know, I've taught a lot of people, and when I teach people how to notice things, the light goes on and it stays on. And the same thing happens if you study graphic design. Once you study graphic design, and there's a famous XKCD cartoon, maybe we could find it and post it with this, where Randall says, if you want to punish someone, teach them what kerning is. Because as soon as you learn how to kern, all type looks wrong. All amateur type. There's something broken about it, because the people who set amateur type don't know about kerning, and they do it wrong. Well, the same thing is true when you start to notice how the internet works. The same thing is true when you start to understand user interface, or when you start to understand how and why people pay attention. You see why certain things are going to work. You look at the Uber app when Uber first launched and you say, Uber's going to work. Or you look at Colors with $45 million invested in it. You say, Colors isn't going to work, because you learn to see. And it's learning to see that turns me on.
And would you say the combination of skills, your ability to write, your ability to understand, marketing, and your ability to understand technology and the internet is what kind of separates you from other writers? That combination of skills? What would you say is your core competence?
Well, one big advantage I have is that the internet showed up just in time, because I write and think at internet speed, mm-hmm. in that I'd rather do a blog post a day than a book a year. A lot of other people can't happily do that. Mm-hmm. And I think the other thing is doing it from this posture of no secrets, tons of generous content. I do that not as a strategy. I do that because I think that's what I should do. And So the idea of showing up regularly, even if the person's never going to buy anything from you, fits into the ethos of the internet. It isn't what bookstores want. It isn't what book publishers want. But it's what the public is interacting with now. So they're, you know, I'm not on Twitter, and it turns out in the long run I would be bad at it because Twitter rewards people who show up even more than I do, even more generously than I do.
Yeah. Talk about that Twitter for a second. I mean, you're basically, you have an account that almost has 500,000 followers and it's all retweets of the blog. Have you thought about even having, you know, someone else run it, you know, kind of taking bits of the blog, or did you just make a conscious decision, hey, you know, not only am I bad at Twitter, but I don't necessarily like Twitter and I don't want to spend time on Twitter. How have you perceived this?
Well, I made a decision a long time ago. If my name is on it, I wrote it. If something comes from Seth Godin, there's only one of me. And I don't have a staff of people churning stuff out, reprinting stuff, filing stuff, etc. That's important to me. I don't think I'm ever going to change that. I didn't engage with Twitter because early on I saw that Twitter was going to work, but that it was going to be a lot of work. And if I was going to do a lot of work on Twitter, I'd have to do less work on something else. And I decided it would be better to be really good at blogging than to be mediocre at both.
Right. And that asks, you know, begs a higher level question is, there's so many different, you know, from all the things you could be writing to all the places you could be speaking to all the other opportunities that result from just your success, how do you, and especially now, how are you prioritizing? And you know, what's important, and how do you think about that?
I would say I'm prioritizing poorly. I am always attracted to shiny objects, always have been. My long arc is this. I want to be known for the people who got taught by the people I taught. So if one of my ideas gets processed through someone else and teaches somebody else, that's a good thing. I'm fine not getting credit for that. If I'm able to make significant change on people who make significant change, that's what I'm trying to do. That's my long line. So a good day is not a day where I won some battle or a day where I brought home some, a moose. A good day is a day where I wrestled with something dark, where I overcame or danced with a fear that let me make a piece of art that will resonate with someone else.
Yeah. You know, and it's you've kind of thought of yourself as a teacher, and you've done different experiments. I remember a few years ago you had this MBA program, and you've had, you know, various internships and fellowships. Do you have any other, you know, kind of upcoming, what were the results of that MBA program? And do you have kind of other upcoming, educational experiments?
I do. And we didn't practice this in advance, but your timing is perfect.
Oh, tell me about it. Perfect.
Alternative MBA that I ran, 9 people spent 6 months in my office at my desk every day for 8 hours. It was awesome. It changed me. It changed them. They're all still amazing people. I get to keep in touch with many of them. It was great. I also knew I couldn't scale it, and it was going to kill me if I did it again. But it has remained front and center for me. So a few months ago, I did a Udemy course on freelancing that has been very successful that I would encourage people to take a look at. But I wanted to do something that was much more intimate, that was much more powerful in the way it changed people. So about 8 weeks ago, I launched something called the Alt MBA. And if you go to info.altmba.com, you can read about it. And it's expensive, and it's by application, and it's around the world. It's virtual, but it's not about secret content. It's about a connection among 100 people. So we just finished the first session, which is a 4-week sprint, today, which is July 13th or 14th. And we're launching the next one in a week or so, and it will start taking place in August and September. So if anyone's interested in hearing about how it went, we profiled a lot of the people who took the course at altmba.strikingly.com, and I'll be blogging about it soon. But that is my best effort at building a semi-scalable system that will really whack people upside the head.
And talk about some of the major philosophies that underlie the the pedagogy and learning experience of the Alt MBA and how that differentiates from current MBA and education programs?
Well, first, let me differentiate it from online learning in general. MOOCs are very cool. The motivated student who for free can access an artificial intelligence course with 100,000 other people might very well learn something amazing. But what we know about MOOCs, particularly free ones, is that there's a 98% dropout rate. That for every 100 people who start one, only 2 people finish. And the reason, I think, is simple. Learning is hard. And when you get to the hard part, it's easier to just quit. So what I wanted to do was not do what some people have done, and they've done it well, which is to say, we made these videos, pay us a bunch of money, you can watch them. I'm doing the opposite. So all the content from this, in terms of the lessons, are on the web or in the bookstore. What we've done is assembled coaches. Each cohort of 20 people is assigned a coach who shepherds them through. We use Slack, we use Zoom HD video conferencing, and we use WordPress. And there's 12 projects that you have to do in public, some in groups, some individually, and post them on the WordPress site. So the stakes are really high. You're not going to drop out. You're not going to do a half-assed job because you're A, surrounded by your fellow students who are looking you in the eye online, and B, you're publishing under your own name in forever on the internet the answers to these projects. And what we discovered after the first one is really working. It is transforming people because it creates social pressure to get you to see the world differently, to ship your art, and to dance with your fear. So I'm fairly optimistic that these techniques are going to be used by other people because it's so clear to me how powerful they are. And we're going to run more sections of this as much as people want to do it.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. You know, you're someone who's thought a ton about and written a ton about learning, about tooling yourself. If you could, and kind of building your arsenal of skill sets to make you indispensable, if you could design, you know, a 4-year university experience for yourself, right, for the ideal kind of learning experience, how would you think about what would need to be involved?
Well, here's the problem with college. College is mostly high school, but with more binge drinking. And we had a brief moment in time where a college degree from a famous institution was a shortcut to indoor white collar work, moving something from one pile to another. And that was a magical 30-year period, because the gap between the people who didn't go to college and the people who did is huge. But now, as we're seeing from everything from the Teal thing to folks who are going to Flatiron School, et cetera, is in a more fluid economy, we're not going to judge you by how famous your college was. We're going to judge you by what you've built. And so for me, spending 4 years going to classes and getting A's makes no sense. It makes more sense to me to learn how to see, learn how to ship, and create a trail behind you of stuff you've made. That doesn't mean you have to be a programmer. You could be an English lit major. But if you're an English lit major, I sure hope that the output isn't A's on your blue books, but the output is truly original research and writing that other people actually want to read. And unfortunately, most institutions are bureaucratic and therefore don't want to encourage you to do something they can't control. They want to encourage you to guess the right answer.
Yeah. Now, you have your kids. Are they going through traditional high school, college, methods? Do you want them to? What do you think?
Well, I wanted my kids to make their own choices, and they did. And my eldest co-founded a company instead of going to college and is doing really great work in New York at Meetup. And my younger son is at the co-op program at Northeastern and already doing productive work after his freshman year. I am super proud of both of them in the sense that I didn't tell them to do this. They decided to do this, and they do it with generosity and with guts.
Yeah. I think it's interesting when, Tony Robbins came on the podcast the other day and he was talking about how his son didn't adopt necessarily the principles that Tony Robbins preaches. I think it's very common, especially when the father is a famous thinker. And I'm curious how you've thought about that with your sons in terms of, just in general. What do you think about that?
Well, there is no family business in the Godin household. My grandfather was in the women's pajamas business, and the other grandfather was a bankruptcy lawyer. So there's a long history of each generation finding their own path. And that's what I taught my kids from the day they were, you know, 6 weeks old, is you're in charge of this. Don't expect that you're just going to do what I did, because you, no one can. There's not going to be another Seth Godin, because there already is one.
No, I hear you. And I'm going back to when you were in high school or college coming up. What, and I know you were saying, you know, that it wasn't natural, but looking back, what kind of skills or what kind of predilections or what type of kid were you that you can, you know, trace the steps looking back and say, oh, this led me to where I am today?
Most people don't believe me when I say that when I was 14, I decided I wanted to do this for a living, but I did, not the writing part anyway, but my English teacher in high school wrote in my yearbook that I was the bane of her existence and I would never amount to anything. That's an exact quote. But I got really lucky in college. I went to Tufts and I found a loophole in their catalog that let me take more courses than anybody else, not worry about my grades, and take them in philosophy, computer science, computer graphics, mechanical engineering, and inventive design. And I just basically took whatever the hell I wanted. I took six courses a semester, and while I was doing it, was lucky enough to co-found a really large student business that we didn't get paid much to run. We made $50 a week, but it didn't matter how big we got. So we weren't trying to make a profit. We were trying to make a ruckus. And all of that swirling around clearly had a huge impact on the life that I lead now. I felt early on that if I tried to compete with the other mechanical engineers, I would fail out of school, because they were willing to work really hard on things they weren't interested in, and I wasn't.
And what? Why did your high school teacher write that you were the bane of her existence in the yearbook?
Well, for two reasons. One, because I was quite a wise ass. She was being a wise ass back. And two, because literature held no attraction for me. And what they teach you in high school English is literature. And I get what the writers of literature are trying to do, but I think that for most of us, Madame Bovary isn't going to get under our skin. And for me, science fiction is what got under my skin. I think that what good writing does, like what I tried to do in Your Turn, is paint a picture that you can't forget. That when you, if you read a Cory Doctorow book, any of the last five Cory Doctorow books, you will never look at the world the same way. And you don't have to be a genius. You don't have to have a PhD from MIT. You just have to like reading fast-moving books. But he is so good at painting a picture. Or David Graeber's new book about debt. You know, it's heavy slogs sometimes. But when you're done, the next time you get a credit card statement in the mail, you're not going to think about it the same way. That is what I think writing is capable of. Taking someone who isn't just going to read another book, but is actually in the world, how can you make that person look at the world differently? So if literature does it for them, I think that's great, but I knew I couldn't contribute on the literature front. I'm trying to instead poke people enough that they'll make a ruckus.
Mm-hmm. And how have you thought about the marketing of this book? And you've gone about it in a different way in terms of how you've put together and what the book looks like. How have you thought about marketing it?
Well, go to yourturn.link. L-I-N-K. It's all one word, Your Turn. And what you'll see there is everything that I have to say about the book, plus some really weird pricing. Because I did not make the book to sell one copy at a time. I made the book, hopefully, so you'll buy 12. And the last time I checked, which was a couple weeks ago, 75% of my sales in the last 3 months have been to people who already bought a copy. And that's stunning. Because for most of my books and for almost everybody else's books, the repeat sales of a book are basically zero. Why would someone who has a book buy it again? And 75% of my customers are repeat customers. That's awesome. Because the purpose of the book is to talk about it with someone you work with, to talk about it with your boss or your investor or your coworkers. Because what the book is about is feeling fear and dancing with it. And it's way easier to dance with fear when you have company than it is to dance with fear by yourself.
Yeah, and if you had kind of one thing you want readers to walk away with your turn. Is that it? Or what do you want them to walk away with?
I want them to understand what I'm talking about when I talk about silence and when I talk about tension. Because we have been pushed so hard to tell the punchline, to diffuse the tension, to get to the point. You know, if you look at something like Product Hunt, you've got, what, 6 words to make it interesting enough for someone to click. So there's no room for tension there. We just assume everyone gets the point, and it's like looking for love in a strip club. I'm not sure that the art is there. Whereas tension, walking up to someone and saying, knock, knock, and then not speaking again until there's enough tension that they finally say, who's there? That moment is when the two of you came together. And that is what we see when we use an amazing product. That if you think about what Marissa Mayer did at Google, I was at Yahoo when Google was launching. Yahoo's homepage at the time had 157 links on it. That every time Yahoo added a link to their homepage, they made more money. So there were 157 links. When Google launched, there were 2. That created tension. Tension, like, what is this thing? What am I supposed to do? Where are all the other things I can click on? And in that tension, she helped create a $100 billion company, right? And that is what Miles Davis did. That is what J.J. Abrams did with the Comic-Con coming attraction of Star Wars that he put up 2 days ago. Because when you look at the Star Wars coming attraction, what you were probably looking for is, show me the short version of the movie you're making so I can have a comment about whether it's good or not. Tell me everything. Show me the punchline. And J.J. didn't do any of that. J.J. instead created more tension by not showing you anything in the movie, instead showing you the joy and the craftsmanship of the people who were making the movie. And by the time you were done watching it, unless you're a lunk, by the time you're done watching it, you look at that and you go, I want to see that. Because if they're this excited about it, I am too.
When you talk to young writers or young marketers who want to do things similar to what you're doing, what's the most common advice you find yourself telling them?
Well, the most tactical advice is blog every day. And it doesn't matter whether you're a marketer or a plumber. Just blog every day. Notice something, write it down. Doesn't matter if you put your real name on it. Doesn't matter if you have any readers. Blog every day. Blogging every day is a gift to you and to the reader. It makes you more honest. It makes you more clear about what your promises you're making to yourself and to other people. And then less tactical is this. I think our economy today is about trust and connection. So again, back to Product Hunt. The minute people think that Product Hunt is easily gamed, then it will go the way of Dig, because you won't trust it. And connection, because if people want to hear from you, you have an asset of value. So the job today is 2. 1, earn the trust of the people who look you up online. Leave a trail behind, not of being some sort of growth hacker who's scamming people, but leave a trail behind of everything you're doing being something that's transparent and vulnerable that you're proud of. And 2 is earn the privilege of permission. Earn the privilege that people want to hear what you're doing next. That if you do those 2 things, then nothing can stop you, because you're always going to be making progress. My friend Jesse Lamb launched a product. It was on top 5 on Product Hunt last week. And Jesse has launched products before this and products before this and products before this, and he will keep launching products. And his products do what he says they will, and they're fairly priced, and he shows up when he says he's going to show up. That's how you earn trust. That's how you earn connection. And each time you do it, you leave a trail behind that lets you do it again.
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, the whole premise, you're right, or one of the main premises of Product Hunt is that it's all about the connection between the maker and the consumer, or the user, or the reader, or whatever. And you know, we try to have every the products that do great have ask me anythings with the maker. So the middleman is kind of, you know, there's not a need for the middleman, just like you've done in your reading. How do you think, you know, that's worked very well in tech, because tech people are kind of just very receptive to it and very adaptable, and they don't need middlemen, you know, to communicate for them. How do you think it's going to work in other verticals? You know, whether it's you know, books is something you're the most familiar with, but things even beyond that. How do you think it's going to, you know, how do you think the product and philosophy and platform is going to work once we extend to books and other verticals? What would be your thoughts and advice there?
Well, I think the magic of the overlap between tech nerds and the internet is that the people who show up first, and you know, you can think about Stack Overflow, you can think about early days at Reddit, you can think about Flickr. The people who show up first in the tech world are the right people. They're the people who are both respected and loud. So if you can seduce the first 10,000, they will probably bring along the right people after that. It gets way harder in other fields. For example, in the book world, the people who show up first are not the people who are at the heart, the red hot center of fiction, or the red hot center of business books. You know, the people who bought the first million Kindle books were mostly women who read romance novels. And so that doesn't put a lot of pressure on other traditional writers to rush to that platform, because the readers weren't their readers. Or if you think about something like industrial chemicals, there are people who buy billions of dollars of industrial chemicals every year. They have a huge need for more information, for more breakthroughs, for more efficiency. I'm not sure they're going to show up at Product Hunt for Industrial Chemicals first. And so that has been the challenge when almost all of these types of sites have tried to branch out into non-tech areas, is it's much harder to grab the New York crowd or the fashion crowd or the product industrial marketing crowd. That takes significantly more effort because those people don't live and breathe the internet.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's interesting. Do you kind of, you know, for in books, for example, do we focus on people, you know, tech and business books, and just kind of hope that you know, that's essentially what we're doing and, you know, hope that we have enough case studies from there. How would you advise? I'm curious with your understanding of both worlds.
Okay. So I guess I would say the short run tactic is clearly books for the people who already trust Product Hunt, because then you've solved the problem of where do I get new readers? You don't. You use the readers you've already got. That's not the long-term way to transform the culture. The long-term way to transform the culture is to figure out how do you know, if I look at Uber, most people who take an Uber are not San Francisco coders. Most people who take an Uber, for example, in New York City, are media executives, are people who aren't necessarily tech people, but they got the app because someone in their circle, in their tribe, told them about it when they arrived at a lunch meeting, right? Let me tell you how I got here. And, you know, this goes all the way back to Vindigo. I don't know if you remember Vindigo. You were probably 12 years old.
Well, I'm 14 now, so I'm just kidding.
Vindigo, I wrote up the case study in Unleashing the Idea Virus, a book I did 15 years ago. And Vindigo was the fastest growing app in history, and it ran on the Palm Pilot. And the way it worked was it was basically Zagat's, but on your Palm Pilot. But after you got it, you could beam it to somebody else. So you'd be going out for lunch with three people, and you say, oh, my Vindigo says we should go to this place. And everyone would say, Vindigo, what's that? And you take out your palm and point it at their palm, and now they had it. And that's the challenge, right? You go find 500 huge fans of, you know, Harry Potter fan fiction, and you figure out why they should tell the other fans of Harry Potter fan fiction about what you're building. And if there's a good reason for them to spread the word, they will. they won't spread it for you. They'll spread it for themselves.
And it's interesting how, you know, with you, it's your turn right now. You have done, you know, you've built it into the product that, you know, people are going to buy multiple copies.
Right. So that I try to take my own advice as much as I can. And if that hadn't worked, I would have sold just a couple thousand copies, because there aren't that many people who, if I say on my blog, please buy my new book, will just go and buy it. Most people want to know, are people like me buying a book like this? Who else liked it? And that is more and more what drives the internet. You know, so Ghost at a Watchman, the new the prequel to Kill a Mockingbird, is the exception. That's a book that sold 2 million copies without any word of mouth at all, nothing but mainstream media. But compare that to 50 Shades of Grey. 50 Shades of Grey is the best-selling book of the last 10 years other than Harry Potter. And it sold partly because you could read it on a Kindle without anyone knowing you were reading soft porn. And it sold because people told other people. It sold a million copies before it had a real publisher. It sold because people told other people.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting right now, we're talking about online communities, and it's interesting time. Obviously, this is what we think about as we're expanding, but also, you know, Reddit is going through kind of their own internal, you know, kind of crises or reorganization. How are you thinking about online communities, you know, in 2015 and going forward? Some of the biggest principles you're thinking about, people should think about when building them?
The biggest principle, and I hope someone will prove me wrong, is that any online place, I'm not going to use the word community, any online place with insufficient rules will quickly go to crap. And it will just stay there. That if you look at Wikipedia, Stack Overflow, Product Hunt, the people who are managing to get big without getting lousy, they do it by having rules. And I know that there's sort of this anarchistic utopian mindset that if we just created a bazaar and let people use it, they would make it better. It's just not true, because the trolls are persistent and they're anonymous and they're selfish. And, you know, when I think about all the impact Craigslist could have had if they had just made a few more rules. And it's tempting. I ran one of these communities for 7 years. It's tempting to give in to pressure and say, okay, fewer rules. But I think the opposite is true. I think that more rules that help the community be civil are key. And my favorite rule by far is no anonymity. And I know a lot of the people from the origin of the net disagree with me, but in my, you know, if you think about going into a bank, if a guy walks into a bank and with a clown mask on, the teller doesn't say, can I help you? The teller hits the alarm, because people don't wear clown masks into banks unless they're there to do something not so good. So in the real world, anonymity is not generally a really helpful thing. It works in certain tiny areas where whistleblowers are important. It works in tiny areas where people without power, like a battered woman, can speak up, for sure. But I'm not sure we've got a lot of whistleblowers in the tech app space. And I think that the more we can give people credit for being the generous contributors that they are capable of being, the more likely it is we can build a community that lasts.
Yeah, you know what's interesting? I agree with you, and I've gone back and forth a bunch, but I also internally, I think, and this problem is much more, you know, salient for you in the sense that, do you ever have ideas that you want to share, or even, you know, conversations that you want to bring up, but you can't because, you know, you have such a wide audience and you don't want to offend a certain group of people? Does that happen at all?
Well, I think the discipline of a professional is to understand that earning the trust of your following means you don't get to do just what you want. You have to do something that keeps the promise that you have made to other people. So yeah, there are lots of things I don't discuss on my blog because that's not what it's for. My blog doesn't say, this is everything that popped into Seth Godin's head, whether or not it's relevant to you. It says, I promised you that every day I would put something up here that I think might resonate with you. That's why you should trust me and come back tomorrow. And I think that when we, I think we overvalue the off the cuff anonymous thing that we might put up on some discussion board if only people couldn't trace it back to us. There's not a lot, I don't see a lot of history of that leading to brave or important change.
Yeah, it's interesting. I know in startups, there's this, I don't know if you've seen Startable Jackson, he's kind of a secret identity who's talking about some stuff like diversity in tech. And sometimes he, you know, he's just making fun of or parodying stuff, but sometimes he's talking about things that, you know, not, you know, venture capitalists couldn't typically talk about. And it's clear he is a venture capitalist.
Yeah, I'm not buying this. You know, it would have been way easier for Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. to be anonymous, don't you think?
Right, right, right.
He probably wouldn't have been shot. And he's a hero. And I'm so glad he was brave enough to stand up. And the fact is that a VC who cares about diversity, and I would put my friend Fred Wilson in this category, should stand up and talk about it. And Fred does. And nothing bad is happening to him. That, you know, venture capitalists are among the privileged, most privileged people in the history of the planet. And nothing bad is going to happen to them. They should speak up and put their name on it.
Yeah. You wrote Tribe, you know, over 5 years ago. How, and you know, that was one of your biggest books. How is your, and Tribe's a concept that's become very popular in the Valley recently, as people look to, you know, as like kind of build, you know, meaning in their friend groups and feel that they've been a little, spread themselves too thin personally. How is the concept of Tribe for you evolved over the years since writing the book?
Well, one thing I'm particularly proud of is I write books. People in the Valley poo-poo them and ignore them for 5 years, and then they use them to build billion-dollar companies. Yeah. And I think that's fabulous, because if they weren't poo-pooing me when the books came out and they made fun of permission marketing and they made fun of Purple Cow and they made fun of Tribes, that's fabulous, because it means that I'm at least a little bit ahead of the cycle, which is the goal. For me, I think the mistake a lot of people can make is calling a group of people my tribe. It's very rare that someone has a tribe. You may be a voice that is listened to by a group of people who self-identify, but they're not yours. You don't get to say, let's go and have everyone do it. And I have resisted really hard pressure to say, these are my people. This is what we're going to do. So I don't sell ads on my blog. I don't sell these people, because they're not mine. And that perspective, I think, is really important, for example, for someone like Product Hunt, because Product Hunt doesn't have a tribe. There was a tribe around before you showed up. You're merely a journal for that tribe, a bulletin board for that tribe. And they will stick with you as long as you serve them. And the minute you stop serving them, they're going to leave.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. Actually, right now I want to respect your time. You know, you got to head out in a sec. So I'll end on this. When you hear the term successful, who's the first person to come into your head and why?
Oh, boy. You know, I'm sitting here in the little audio studio I have, and on the wall is a poster for Buckaroo Banzai, Across the Eighth Dimension, a really bad movie that was made a long time ago that I named my company Yoyodyne after. And on the poster is Peter Weller, John Lithgow, also John Big Boutte, but I don't know what actor played him, and Ellen Barkin and Jeff Goldblum and Christopher Lloyd. Every one of those actors is successful by the definition that they didn't do the next movie Hollywood told them to. Every one of them is successful because they did the work they wanted to do. So none of them were the biggest John Travolta stars. They were unique. There was no substitute for any of them. You don't say, John Lithgow won't do it. Get me that other guy who's just the same. And for me, successful in our economy today means deciding what matters and not trading it away.
Yeah. And we have more and more the freedom to do so. So, and just a quick follow-up, as you know, this is your 18th, you know, book, what do you have left to do and to accomplish? And what are some of the biggest things you're going to be thinking about in the next years?
You know, I've spent time with Acumen Fund in India, in Kenya, with their advisors in New York. We're not aware of how privileged we are and of the resources that we have. I want to keep reminding myself of how much leverage all of us have. I have a little bit extra compared to some people, but all of us have this leverage. I did a promo for Charity Water a couple of days ago, and we probably raised enough money to save another 100,000 people's lives. That's a pretty good day for a blog post. And so that idea that we are busy sending bits around the world, I think it's important we don't get too confused about the difference between the leverage we have today and the impact we make in the long run. And I am actively thinking hard about what kind of cultural shift are we going to be able to make so that 10 years from now, it leaves a really positive impact behind.
That's a good place to end as any. Thank you, Seth, for taking the time to chat with us.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for the work you're doing, Eric, and keep making a ruckus.
Absolutely. The book is Your Turn, and we will chat with Seth on Product Hunt about it soon. I'm looking forward to it.
Cheers.
Okay. Bye, Seth.